What's up, bingers? We've got another great show for you this week. I'm joined by another fantastic guest. He is one of the co-hosts of the amazing True Crime Garage podcast. The man with no last name, he's Captain's best friend, the one and only Nick. And Nick is here today to talk about a fascinating and very topical case. We're going to be discussing the murders of Abby Williams and Libby German, also known as the Delphi murders. From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. All right, Nick, how you doing, buddy?
Doing great. How are you, Bob?
Doing really well. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me, and I'm super duper excited about the case that you've chosen to chat about, which we'll get into in a few minutes. But so for you listeners, for those of you that are crossover people that came from Truth and Justice, and now you're here on True Crime Binge, you heard me talk about the Delphi case with Barb and Drew from the Down the Hill podcast, and I was obsessed with the case before that. I'm still obsessed with the case after that. And when I asked Nick from True Crime Garage to come on, he wants to talk about it because he's equally obsessed with it. So I'm dying to dig even further into it. Before we do that, Nick, I need you. So your partner in crime, Captain, he told some stories about you. And oh. I want to see if we can verify. Captain was on the Truth and Justice episode during season 9. And he told us a story about how the podcast came to be. And he blames the True Crime Garage podcast 100% on you. Is that accurate?
True Crime Garage blames it on me. Yeah. I'm fine with that. That seems pretty accurate. It's one of those situations where, hey, look, you get all the credit, but you also take all the blame.
And, right.
We had talked about doing a podcast for a good amount of time before actually doing it. It was because we were listening to them, and he and I always loved talk radio anyway. And we both have a music background. He much more than I do. And he's gone to school for recording engineering and things like that. And it was always something that as friends that we would joke around over drinks and say, yeah, that's something we could do. We could do that. That wouldn't, you know, wouldn't be too hard. And then of course, you start doing it and it's much more difficult than you think. But anyway, the short of it is he was kind of kicking around ideas of, well, we have to have a topic. What are we going to talk about? And I kept shooting ideas down. And finally I told him, I said, I think true crime is what we're going to talk about. And he said, well, why? He goes, that's, you know, I was always much more into it than he was. However, what I thought was really interesting was, he was living in Indiana and I was living in Columbus, Ohio. Uh-huh. And we grew up super tight and we would have these phone conversations and they would generally, you know, could be long conversations because we wouldn't see each other hardly ever. But if we got on the topic of true crime, usually he would bring it up, something he had heard. And we would talk for an hour, hour and a half. And it was just, I thought, just fascinating conversation. So it seemed like a no-brainer to me. Why not give this a shot? It's something that I'm knowledgeable about. It's something that he can jump in and talk about pretty well. So it kind of seemed, and then we started recording in my garage. So True Crime Garage, the name seems a little dumb to people out there, but but I think it describes to a T everything that we were doing when we decided to do this.
Right. You guys just had an anniversary. I saw on social media, I don't know when this is going to air, but the day we're recording this, I believe yesterday on social media, there was the Throwback Thursday photos of you guys recording your first episode in the garage.
Yeah, it must have been some kind of anniversary that I'm just clueless to.
the captain handles
by
the social
this point.
Media, does he?
Well, and we're coming up, you know, we've done over 400 episodes, and so I'm, you know, I kind of got my sights on 500, so that's what I'm looking forward to.
Right. Is 500 a landmark, or are you talking 500s when you hang it up?
I think it's a landmark. I think I'm going to be shocked that we made it that far. You know, 100 seemed big, and then 200, and now we've been really at it for a while, and 500 just seems like a milestone to me. It's something that, look, when we first started doing this, we didn't think anybody was going to listen to two idiots in a garage talking about stuff that we're interested in. We didn't know everybody else was interested in it too, or would want to hear our thoughts or opinions. And so we've been very lucky, and we got a great audience, and it's great to be able to interact with them, be it through our website or you know, when we do Crime Con. And it's been great meeting people like you, Mr. Ruff. We've had some great times, and this is not our first time talking on mic either. You know, you've been gracious and come on our show several times, and we had a lot of fun talking West Memphis 3 with you. And I really enjoyed and appreciated all the work you did on that case as well as other cases.
Speaking of which, you should listen to the follow-up that we just released today when we get off, because I have an update on that, which I won't waste too much airtime here because it'll be old news when this airs. But you may want to check out the first 20 minutes of today's follow-up regarding
the case. I will.
So you said you have I knew Captain had a music background. What is your background? You mentioned you have a music background, but you know, where do you come from?
Well, my music background is nowhere near. It's almost silly to mention it in comparison to
the clarinet.
The xylophone. I played the maracas on several Steely Dan songs professionally. So I am a professional musician. Now that's a joke, but. No, growing up, I played some stringed instruments, and at one point was in a band with the captain for several years. We were in two different bands over the course of about 6 years. I mean, that's a long time. And so we had a lot of fun doing that. But I mean, he's actually gone to school for being a musician and things like that, where I did a little bit of that in middle school and high school. And then we had some fun with our hard rock, heavy metal band that we were in for some years together.
Did you do any vocals, or were you what was your position in the band?
I was the front man. Yeah. I was
the front man.
Yeah.
Yep. Nice. With a guitar or just you and a microphone?
No. So, originally, I was the one that asked him to join the band. He was about 2 years younger than the rest of the guys that we were hanging out with. And I asked him, I said, "Hey, would you join this band?" And he's like, not really my thing." You know, he wasn't really much of a heavy metal guy. And I said, "Well, you have to." He goes, "What do you mean I have to?" And I said, "I've learned that first of all, I'm not a very good singer anyway. So, but I said to him, I remember saying to him, I said, I can't sing and play bass at the same time. I mean, that is extremely difficult, and for me anyway. And I said, so I'm going to be the singer. I need you to join the band and play the bass. Take some pressure off of me. So, and you know, he was the youngest guy in the band, but very quickly the most talented. We all noticed that he was the most talented amongst us.
God, tell me there's video of this out there somewhere. There has to be video of you as the front man and the captain on the bass. It's out there, right?
So the videos that I'm aware of, thank God they're on VHS, and I don't know that too many people these days know how to transfer that to digital format.
I do.
I'm going to get emails now from people offering their services, and maybe when we reach episode 1000, we'll release the old tapes to the world.
You know, in preparation for that, so it's funny you mentioned that, because I had to go to Houston for a Truth and Justice case, and just last week, and I got called by the woman at the clerk's office and told me, like, there's in this case file there's a VHS tape. I don't know what's on it. I have no way of playing it. But if you want it, you've got to find a way to get it. So I had to go borrow a VCR, which are hard to come by nowadays, by the way.
Right.
I found somebody that had a working VCR. Then I bought some hardware and some software, and I had to fly my VCR with me down to Houston, and then walk into the office with it under my arm and copy this video over. So, you know, I've got everything, you know, before it degrades, we should get together, have a beer. We're not too far away from each other. I'll go ahead and copy all those videos, make them digital, you know, for you guys. I promise I won't do anything with them. They won't accidentally end up on my YouTube page or anything like that.
They won't accidentally. No. It's one of those things, like, it was one of the best experiences in my lifetime. Absolutely. Uh-huh. I played all kinds of sports growing up, but nothing gave me a bigger thrill than being on stage, hanging out with the buddies, everything like that, putting music together. But it's also one of those things that, you know, we did that as, we started a lot of that as teenagers, and uh-huh. kind of when I departed from that world would be right around college age. So as an adult now, you kind of look back and you cringe a little bit, because right. I mean, I think that's natural, but it's also funny because if you get about 5 or 6 beers in me, I start going, man, I don't understand why we didn't have a record deal.
How did we not make it big?
How were we not huge?
Right. And see, and it's in those instances where you need to be able to just pull up those videos right on your phone and watch them.
That's right.
Or work on it.
That's right.
So you went to college. What is your background? You weren't a professional podcaster your whole life. This started, what, about 5 years ago you guys started True Crime Garage?
Yeah, 2015. Late 2015.
So just over 5 years ago. So before that, what'd you do? You went to high school. I assume you went to high school with the captain.
Correct.
Is that how you guys were friends?
Yep.
And you make a band. What else happens between? I'm going to take a guess, just because I feel like we're close to the same age. You graduated what, 96, 97, 98?
Oh, see, you're going. This is all personal stuff. I don't like to do a lot of personal stuff, but okay, we'll peek behind the curtain a little bit. I was supposed to graduate in 1998 from high school. Okay. And about 2 weeks before my junior year was over, they called me down to the office, and I was thinking, oh, great. What's going on now? And they said, the counselor said, hey, you can graduate as a junior if you want. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, because there was like a credit increase between my junior year and my senior year. So at the end of my junior year, I qualified for the state requirements to graduate from high school per the required credits. He goes, you've achieved all the required credits you need. If you decide to take your senior year, you'll need, I don't know if it was 1 credit or 1.5. It was something very small. And I said, oh, well, that's cool. I'll just come back next year and I'll take, like, you know, 1 class. And he's like, you can't do that. He's like, state law requires you to be in school for, I don't know if it was 4 hours or 5 hours a day. Right. And I was like, okay, 9 months of 4 or 5 hours a day or just be done with it. Mm-hmm. So I missed my senior year. I ended up graduating as a junior in 1997.
So we graduated the same year.
There you go.
Except for you're smarter than me because you graduated a year early.
No, that's a big misconception. A lot of people think that I'm like smart because I graduated as a junior. No, I'm probably dumber than half the guys that graduated in 98. And it was really one of those things, Bob, like I was the kind of kid, if I wasn't busy, I would end up in trouble. So I never took a study hall. I always just took classes, and I did that to keep myself out of detention, and it ended up with a ton of credits by the end of my junior year.
That's awesome. So then you went to college as like Doogie Howser. You're younger than everybody, right?
Well, yeah. Well, no, I took a little bit of time off and started late. And I actually, while we were doing True Crime Garage, towards the beginning of it anyway, this is the boring adult stuff. I worked in property management for a very long time. I don't know, 15, 16 years. Some of that did involve a portion of that was about 3.5 years where I was a security administrator for a high rise building in downtown Columbus. So I have a security background from that angle. And I was a bartender for a while as well. So
how long were you a bartender?
About 3 years.
3 years. I'm going to ask you a question. I've asked another one of our guests how to make this drink, who also was a bartender for a couple of years. How good are you at remembering how to make drinks?
There are like five or six that I can make in my sleep. And those are the real popular drinks. Outside of that, I need a little recipe menu, but I can. Yeah.
This one's not complicated.
Okay. Go for it.
Do you remember how to make my favorite drink? I'm a big bourbon on the rocks guy, but if I'm feeling a little saucy when I go into a bar, I might order myself a Manhattan, like a Woodford Reserve Manhattan up.
See, this,
if
this
I ordered that, could you make it?
So you order it up. No, not on the rocks.
No, if I get a Manhattan, it's up.
Okay, so my go-to drink is a Manhattan on the rocks. So
okay.
If I were to make one for you and you don't want rocks, it's pretty simple. It's bourbon, sweet vermouth, and a couple of dashes of bitters. Now, I like a little less sweet vermouth than most places, and I like a little more bitters than most places.
Yeah, you know, samesies. But there's a key part of this is when you mix it up, how are you mixing it? Once you get this all into the chilled container, are you shaking or stirring?
I get mine shaken because I like we're getting pretty deep here. I like the way that the ice will bruise the alcohol is what you call that. And to me, there's something magical that happens during that perfect point where just the right amount of ice is melted into the bourbon. It like super opens it up. I don't know. I could drink bourbon on the rocks. You know, I shouldn't say every day. We don't want to say that, but yeah, I like a Manhattan on the rocks. One cherry. I've noticed that like the really good cocktail places, it seems to me like they nail the first Manhattan, and I don't know if they hit me with too much sweet vermouth on the second one.
They get lazy. I think they get lazy.
I find that most places I go, because you can tell the color is a little different.
Right.
Like, this one's a little darker, and that comes from the sweet vermouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so generally, I got three places around here that they make a fantastic Manhattan. The first one, the second one, not as good as what I can make at home.
Yeah, I have the same issue. I'm a stirred guy. I get violently furious if they shake my Manhattan. Of course, I'm usually getting it up too. But if I get it back and it's like frothy, the bourbon's bruised, it upsets me. But I can respect that you enjoy. It's not a mistake. You just like it better that way.
I like the way that the ice would bruise the alcohol and open it up. But as a former bartender, if somebody ordered it up, I would assume to stir it. That would be my assumption that I would make. But I always tell anybody, you know, anybody bartending, it's better to ask than to just, you know, you get some of these guys that are like, oh, I know what I'm doing. You know, I'm super right. Bartender guy. No, just ask, you know, because when I would bartend, there'd be other guys and they'd be like, oh, the proper way is, you know, the proper etiquette is this, the proper way is this. And I would always remind them, no, the proper way is to give the customer exactly what they want, regardless of how snobby you want to be about it. Right. At the end of the day, it's to make the customer happy. It's to make them want their second, third drink and make them a regular.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. So, and you're a bourbon on the rocks guy too, which is really my go-to. I actually rarely order Manhattan anymore. What's your favorite go-to bourbon, or do you have a selection of go-to bourbons if you're just drinking them on the rocks?
So you're a little fancier than me, because if I have a rule that if somebody else is paying, or if it's, you know, open bar somewhere, then I might get a little fancy with it. But if I'm getting a Manhattan, I'm fine with whatever, you know, Jim Beam, just any pretty standard bourbon, because you're adding to it. You know, there's
right.
To me, there's no point in top shelf liquor for, you know, a mixed drink when you're adding those extra notes in there. But if I were to just have a bourbon on the rocks, which I would have it. Blanton's is fantastic. I really like, and some of my bourbon buddies kind of, they don't, I don't think they see eye to eye with me on this because they like Blanton's Jefferson Reserve. Very good.
Mm-hmm.
I like Four Roses Small Batch, the single batch. I can't remember if they call it small batch or single batch, but
I haven't tried that one.
Four Roses is fantastic. Give that one a shot, but go expensive on it. Get the small batch or the single barrel or whatever it's called.
I just discovered a couple new ones recently. Have you tried Angel's Envy?
No, I've actually not even heard of that one.
I was at my wife and I went out to dinner the other day and I saw it and it looked fancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had to do the thing, which you know, really makes you feel like a piece of shit when you're like, hey, yeah, could I get a, actually, how much is a glass of the Angel's Envy? I will never do that, but as I was ordering, it occurred to me is like, shit, what if they pour that and then they're like, that was $200. Congratulations.
You didn't even know the price when you ordered.
No, I had no idea. I just knew that it was like, there was like the top shelf and they had it kind of displayed. And I was like, oh, I want to try that. And I was like, wait a minute, I might want to hit the brakes on this. It was $15 for a glass. So it wasn't too bad, but
not terrible.
Yeah, but I definitely had to ask on that one, but it's really good. It's like, it's aged in like a wine barrel instead of just your traditional charred barrel. So it's almost got a little bit of sweetness to it. And on the other, that's not super expensive. My brother for Christmas got me a bottle. Have you tried the tin cup bourbon?
The captain had some of that over at his place. Yes, I've tried that. It's pretty good. It's
smooth.
Yeah. You know, another one that's not very expensive that I really like is Bullet. Bullet bourbons. Yeah,
Bullet's a good one.
Yeah, pretty solid. But yeah, I like Woodford Reserve. That was my go-to for a while. Another one that's not terribly expensive that I think it's surprisingly good every time I have it is Maker's Mark. They know what they're doing.
Maker's is a go-to for me because a lot of bars have it. Like when last time we were hanging out at Crime Con, you know, if they don't have a lot of bourbons, if they got Maker's, Maker's is always going to be good.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, you can't go wrong with Maker's.
So there you have it, listeners. These are all the bourbons that you're going to want to check out. And I kind of forgot we were making a podcast, and I was just chatting with you about bourbons.
I'll tell you what, I usually have a Manhattan or a bourbon on a Friday, and here we are talking on a Friday. And
right.
I'm craving one right now.
I am too.
Thanks to you, Mr. Ruff.
Soon, this evening. Unfortunately, it's still morning here. I did have one left. Little side note, people. I'm on the. Never mind. I'm not gonna. Okay. I'm on the wagon of quitting nicotine right now.
Oh,
after a lifetime of it. So I'm like 2 days nicotine free. So I had the very rare Thursday night glass of bourbon last night. Just trying to think about something besides the nicotine, but also a little bit of brain fog. Anyway, that little bit's extra for all of you guys. That bit's for free.
Good for you, man. Good for you. I'm one of those idiots that I've quit smoking multiple times. And I mean, not like the 2 days or 1 week or 2 weeks. Right. I mean, I've quit for 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years. And then,
dude,
then I pick it up again. Like, and then I'll smoke for 6 months and then I'll quit for 6 months. And I haven't right now. I've not had any nicotine at all for like 2 years now. But I'm one of those dudes that if I have one, I'm right back on it.
Right back at it.
Yeah.
I'm the exact same, dude. I grew up in high school. I chewed tobacco. I was a Copenhagen guy and I chewed for years and years and years, and I'd quit for six months and then, you know, go fishing or something. I'm like, I'm throwing a dip while I'm fishing, and right back at it again. And then like 10 years ago, I took up smoking. And then I quit. Then I used the electronic cigarettes to quit smoking and then was hooked on those.
Mm-hmm.
And then this latest round, which Mike and I just broke this down the other day, is the worst. I had quit. My wife, Mike, and I quit smoking all at the same time with electronic cigarettes.
Right.
And then we all quit the electronic cigarettes at the same time and went through the withdrawals and everything. 6 months passed. And then 2017, one day, it was almost a year. Mike and I are on the road investigating the West Memphis 3 case. And out of nowhere, for no reason at all, we pulled into a gas station and I came out with a pack of Marlboros and lit up a cigarette. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, we're on the road, couple of fellas, you know, just have myself. And then it's been since then that I have been on nicotine in one form or another until this week.
See, my trouble spot is if I'm like on vacation, you know, where you're like kind of stacking up back to back days of drinking, and then
right.
And then I'm like middle of my vacation, I'm like, oh, hand me one of those. And then
turns into just have one while you're drinking.
It's all over. Yeah. And then I hate myself.
Right. I hate myself so bad right now, Nick. You can't even imagine. Because of the, you know, so you've been through the withdrawal, the nicotine withdrawals, and you know how that makes you feel. And I'm just like, why are you so goddamn stupid? Because I had already done this multiple times.
Mm.
And I'm doing it to myself again.
Hey, if you can get past the first week, usually that's the toughest part.
Yeah, I'll hang in there. You know, last question about your personal life. And I don't know why I don't know this, but are you you single guy, married guy, wife, kids?
Married.
Married. Children?
One child.
How old's that child?
It's my stepdaughter, and she's grown. She's an adult.
She's grown.
Yeah.
Oh, so you have no little ones in the house?
No little ones in the house.
Oh, I only have three left in the house.
It's an amazing thing when, you know, as much as you love them, it's also a lot of fun when they move out. I'm not going to lie. But Bob, sometimes they move back in then they move out again too. And then they move back in.
right. Oh yeah. I'm sure we got plenty of that. My oldest stepson is 20 and he's been out and back and out and back a couple times. He's doing well. But then I still have my oldest boy is about to turn 16, and my stepdaughter just turned 15, and my youngest son next week turns 10. So I've got all kinds of, that's why I drink and do nicotine.
Right. You know? Of course. Blame it on the kids.
The children.
Right. You are literally killing dad.
Right. Look what you're doing to me.
Look at what you're doing.
Dude, I ate two bowls of this secret time. I had two bowls of a Cinnamon Toast Crunch this morning, which is so I don't eat that kind of food ever. But I'm the nicotine withdrawal thing is like my body's craving something, and I just keep throwing anything I can find into my face hole, trying to satiate it. Becky, my wife, walked out this morning. She's like, "What the fuck are you doing?" And I'm sitting there eating a giant bowl of fucking Cinnamon Toast Crunch with me. Even the kids are like, "Dad, what is happening to you?"
Don't judge.
So, all right, we're gonna get into this case, I promise. All right, here we go. The Delphi murders. This is the murder of Abigail Williams and Liberty German, respectively 13 and 14 years old. We're coming up on, this will be what, 4 years, the anniversary?
Yeah, so Libby and Abby were dropped off at the trail leading to the Monon High Bridge in Delphi, Indiana on February 13th, 2017. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they never came home that night. And this case has been one that I'm sure, you know, Your audience is very intelligent, very dialed in, so I'm sure that most of your listeners are already very aware of this case, but it's been all over the news, and it's been, I think a lot of people really scratch their heads and say, why is this case still unsolved to this day? Coming up on 4 years, like you said, it's a rare case where we have a picture and a short video with audio of the perpetrator, of the killer. And here we are 4 years later, you and I talking about it. And I don't know that we know anything more today than we did that, you know, that first 6 months.
Right. It's interesting. The police have actually done a good job, I think. I hope. But they've done a good job of keeping all the details to themselves, not sharing it, which is, you know, content creators like us, that's really frustrating because I want to know what the hell happened. But they have not shared it. Like, And I didn't really realize that until I started really digging into the case a couple months ago, that, like, we don't know, were they sexually assaulted? We don't know what was the actual manner of death, the injuries, you know, none of that stuff has been shared. We just kind of know where they were at, where they were found, and that's basically it. And for the longest time, we just, I remember when they put out the sketch and the picture of the guy on the bridge,
mm-hmm.
and police said, this is the guy that killed them.
Right.
And I remember thinking, well, how do they know? Like, that could just be some, and then we find out later that, you know, they have a lot more than we know as far as, like, the video. They do know for a fact that's the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen, just in the last couple of days, there's been released, like, 3D, some kind of 3D rendering CGI of somehow. Somebody has made, like, a 3D rendered video of the attack on Abby and Libby. Have you seen that online?
No, I have not. That's news to me. I'll certainly check that out. But you're saying it's kind of a dramatization of what they believe happened?
Yeah. It's still only those, you know, the police, when they released the, like, just a couple steps to show the kind of the gait of the man
okay.
walking towards them. But it's a 3D rendering of that. Like, it's like a 3-4 second video from what I've seen. But it's behind, and it actually shows. It's showing Abby and Libby in comparison to where he's at. So, and I don't know if this is from law enforcement but obviously it looks like they took reference points of, because you see, like, I think it's Libby holding the camera, and it's, you know, the angle that she would have been holding the camera from and where he was coming. It's interesting. I haven't really looked into it much either. I just happened to see it come across, you know, social media in the last day or so.
When I hear something like that, and I'm certainly intrigued and I'm going to check it out, my first question I have is, who put this together? You know what I mean?
Right.
If it's coming from Indiana State Police or the FBI or something, that holds a whole lot more weight than, sure. You know, me or you putting it together on our computers. And
right.
Because I think what is problematic, but also maybe necessary, who knows? It's really tough to say because we don't have all the answers in this case. But I do feel like this case in particular, because they've done such a good job, law enforcement, of withholding information and have held back so much information from the public, that it's left the public to fill in a lot of the blanks along the way. And
which has caused problems.
It has, by law enforcement's own words, in this particular case, it has caused problems. So it's a very intriguing case. And I see why the public is so captivated by it. I mean, just the start of it to begin with, it's incredibly tragic. It's a horrific case. I mean, some monster decided to do this horrible act and to take two juvenile victims with them that day. And, you know, it's really one of those cases, too, that for me, and I know for a lot of people out there, it's heartbreaking. It really is. And I was able to meet with some of the family members at a couple of the crime cons that you and I did. And I've been able to, interview the sister and speak with her at length. And, so I actually have on my wall over here, there's a newspaper clipping from a local newspaper, from Carroll County, Indiana, that says real big, "Justice for the Girls." And it has a picture of Libby and a picture of Abby, and it has their date of birth and the date of their death. And it also has a picture of who is this man, which I call Bridge Guy. Some people call him Bridge right. Guy. And it's the color photo of the man seen on the bridge wearing the blue coat. And we can't seem to decide or agree upon if he's wearing a hat or not, or if it's just the way his hair looks as he's looking down, because he's not looking at their camera. And right. It also has a picture, the sketch, which is typically known as the second sketch that police released of what this individual may look like. This sketch has also been referred to as the younger perpetrator or the younger man sketch. And so for those that are a little unfamiliar with the case, as we said, these two young girls are dropped off that day. It's like a 1:30, 1:35 in the afternoon. Libby's sister, Kelsey, is the young lady that I've spoke to. is she was the one that dropped them off that day. This was kind of a last minute thing. You know, right. Hey, we want to go to these trails. And for those that are unaware of the area, this Monon High Bridge is like an old abandoned railroad bridge. And when you see that thing, can you imagine that a train once would pass over that?
No.
I mean,
not at all. Have you been there?
No, I've not physically been there.
So just, I didn't mean to derail you, and we'll get back into it. But this is the, as we were getting ready, you know, launching our Zoom call today for this, all I was thinking was, you know, Delphi is about 2.5 hours from me. It's got to be about that from you, right? Do you know about how far it is?
Yeah, so I've looked it up. It's a little over 3 hours for me. And I have considered going there.
We should totally meet there.
I would love to.
Dude, we should go there. And like, I want to walk. All the crimes that I work, that I investigate on Truth and Justice, one of the things I always do is like physically go to the crime scene and try to put myself in the mind of the, you know, there's decisions they're making right along the way. Like, why did they go down the hill here instead of here? Why did they approach here? Why did he take them and kill them here? And I just want to see it. I want to physically do it. We should go there sometime and get a bourbon at a local yep. bar and then go walk that trail.
Or reverse order, but yeah.
Yeah, seems the better idea, given the, you know, it's a tall bridge.
Right.
Yeah.
So this bridge, I believe that it's like 80 feet high.
Yeah, I've heard between 70 and 90 feet at parts. Okay. Yeah.
But from my understanding, and the way that this case is, and a big reason why this case has become so popular in the media, is the fact that they have video of the bridge guy. And mm-hmm. this came about because at some point these girls were spooked by this guy enough. And this is, I'm throwing in a little opinion here because we don't know for certain, but my opinion is, and it's been the opinion of the victims' families as well, that this guy must have spooked them. And that is why Libby decided, hey, I'm going to film this guy with my camera phone. And, right. The distance from it's what's been reported and what I've read is the distance from one side of the bridge to the other is about 65 feet. And you can, you can correct me if at any time I say,
I don't know. I don't know. That seems shorter. I was thinking longer, but I don't know. I've never actually read about it.
And it may be a little further. I'm going off of memory here, Bob. Maybe 65 feet is believed to be the distance between Bridge Guy and Libby, who's filming Bridge Guy. Mm-hmm. But regardless, 65 feet does not take very long for one to traverse. So. Right. At some point, they decide that this guy is creepy enough that they want to capture an image of him on their camera. And we have Libby's grandfather who has said, you know, this is not terribly surprising to us. We really believe that this dude must have creeped them out somehow. She decides to film him, probably with the idea of, oh, later I'll show grandma and grandpa, hey, check out this weird dude that we saw at the park, or this weird mm-hmm. dude that we thought maybe he was following us, and they would have a laugh about it. And
sorry to interrupt you, but I'm curious, do you think that was the purpose of the video? Because I have an opinion on that too.
So one thing about this case, there's been a lot of rumors, and you don't know if they're completely made up or if they've been leaked out. Mm-hmm. And one of the rumors is, so the families, and some, there are some truths and some facts in here, and I'll try to clarify as I go along. But one fact that we know is that family members were shown and listened to a little over 2 minutes of audio, where us in the general public, we've only heard that very short snippet of guys down the hill. And when they first released it, it was just down the hill. And then later they released guys down the hill. And to me, the guys down the hill, I actually think that it's clipped and pieced together. I think that there's something between the guys and down the hill. What is missing is the girls. One of the girls is saying something at that point. and they've chosen to cut that out because we, the public, we don't need that. That doesn't help their investigation at all for us to hear any of the girls. Now, I was able to find what I believe to be a transcript of that portion of the audio. And if it is to be correct, what I saw is it's my understanding that if this is correct, that one of the girls was terrified enough that she was not speaking to the bridge guy, that she would speak to her friend, but not to bridge guy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was, you know, kind of acting or speaking on the behalf of both of them. And so one thing we know to be fact is that the family members did listen to a little more than 2 minutes worth of audio. So they have more audio than what we've been shown.
Right.
However, everything I've heard is that there's very little of use of anything of use on the rest of that audio.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
I mean, there's some other rumors and thoughts of what was heard on there, but one thing that's been reported is that one of the first pieces of audio that you hear is they're referencing Bridge Guy as that creepy guy.
Oh, okay.
And that's, you know, there's most of it's it's audio that you can't do anything with because it's not a lot of dialogue. It's not a lot of dialogue. Right. It's a lot of what you hear kind of in the background on the guys down the hill portion where it sounds like leaves rustling or maybe the phone is in someone's pocket and picking up that kind of noise. But
that's what I think. I think that she was so, I don't think that it was, you know, hey, look at this creepy guy. I feel like the video started because they actually saw him as a threat.
Yeah.
And that they started videoing it. And then I think it seems as you piece all this together, like you're saying, it seems that she, once he got close enough, she put her phone in her pocket, but kept it recording, didn't stop the recording. And I wonder, like, was that, I feel like that was like foresight on her part. Like, you know, obviously she's not thinking she's going to be murdered, but she knows something's happening.
Right.
And leaves it recording. And I think, yeah, so the audio, I'm sure that exists is a lot of, you know, the sound of a phone in a pocket. And there's no video because the phone's in her pocket. And obviously the killer doesn't know the phones or they would have taken it, you know? So I think that she was able to get a quick video and stuff it in her pocket.
Well, and you can also think about how this would go down. So if Libby's holding up her phone and, you know, some of the things that we know to be fact is we do have a picture of Abby who is, she's walking across the Monon High Bridge. We have that picture. That picture is released on Libby's Snapchat, I believe at like 2:07 p.m. So they're dropped off at 1:35. About a half hour later, they're crossing the bridge and she's taking a picture to capture that moment, capture that memory. and post it. And so the Monon High Bridge is kind of, it's one of those things where this is an area where teenagers would go and kind of hang out. But you also have adults that would walk the trails. It's a trail system basically. And it, the prize of the trail system there is that old abandoned railroad bridge. Now I'm guessing they probably do not recommend that people go across it. Cause it, I mean, one slip it and it's lights out, man. I mean, you're,
and that's, and you're talking about a tall bridge with, you know, like railroad ties that are, I don't know, 6 inches a foot in between them, you know, with gaps between them.
It's going over water. So what we see here is, you know, she's got to be holding up that phone to capture Bridge Guy's image on that video. But what we see in the video is, and this is why we can't tell if Bridge Guy's wearing a hat or if it's just his hair, because it's a grainy video taken from 65 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And what's he doing? He's looking down not to hide himself from her camera. He's looking down to make sure he doesn't trip. Going across these railroad, you know, ties. And I think that personally, I think that that there's only two reasons why he would have creeped them out. That he was either someone that they passed along their way to the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Either he said something or looked at him weird or whatever, because there's basically, you can say one route to get to the bridge, but there is a little part that the trail that kind of comes off the one end there. So he could have been back there and not crossed paths with them before they got to the bridge. But I think one of two things happened. Either A, they passed him on their way to the bridge and he kind of creeped them out for whatever reason. And then they see him again on the bridge, or he started following them at some point. The other thing, though, too, he could have been like a deer hunter. He could have been sitting somewhere waiting for what he's looking for to cross that bridge. And I've said this a lot because I feel like it's a very strategic move on his part, whether he was watching and waiting off to the side somewhere or if he passed them on a trail. They became at a very big disadvantage once they got to the other side of that bridge. Once they got even halfway across the bridge.
Right.
Because now,
they can't flee quickly.
If you're afraid of this dude, you have two options. Once you get to the other side of that bridge, there's a lot of activity on the one side of the bridge where Bridge Guy came from and where the girls came from. On the side that they're going to, there's not people over there. That becomes private property almost immediately. There's it's kind of a rite of passage in that town where people, when you're a teenager, you dare your friend to cross the bridge, or, oh, you've never crossed the bridge. I've done it before. Let's go do it. And, but I've talked to people from Delphi and they've all told me the same thing. Even if it's your first time or your 10th time, when you get to the other side of that bridge, you turn right around and come right back. You don't,
there's nothing over there.
Nobody does anything on the other side of that bridge. And if they do, it's very uncommon. So, once they get to that side of the bridge, 65 feet away from Bridge Guy, from the killer, they have two options. Do we sit here on this side of the bridge on the private land side and wait for this creep that, that we're already spooked out about to get to the side with us? Or do we cross him on this little narrow bridge to get back to the other side?
Right.
They're at a huge distance. He almost has them cornered, even though there's nothing but open land on that side.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an organized offender that planned this. I think he planned the kill site. I think what probably creeped him out is, I do believe, and this is just, you know, this is 100% just my opinion.
Right.
But it seems to me when look, and that's why I want to go walk the crime scene, because it seems to me that for them to film it, that maybe he was waiting posted up on the side they came from,
right,
and they see this creepy weird guy there. He waits until they get halfway across the bridge and then starts following them, and they're like, they're walking into this trap that, you as you said, you know, that once they get over there, they're screwed. And I think they get to the other side and he's coming and they're kind of trapped over there, and that's when the camera turns on. But then once he gets them over there, I don't know what your thoughts are. You know, when they come out with the second sketch later, a year later, and then they say they're asking about a car that was parked at the abandoned CPS building, which is way to the northwest of kind of the actual crime scene.
Right.
To me, it seems like based on trapping them there, taking them down the hill across the creek where they were actually killed is right below that cemetery. And speaking to people who have been there, it seems that you could drive a car to the back end of that cemetery.
You absolutely can. You absolutely can.
You can't see it from the road.
Right.
And so that's, it confused me. The police, like, to me, you know, trying to put myself in the mind of the sick killer, if this is what you're going there to do, you go and you park at the back of that cemetery. You have your kill site set up. You go to the other side of the bridge, wait till you get somebody trapped. And I believe there has to be a weapon. I don't know how you control two girls without a weapon. You know, one maybe with a threat, but not two. And they just funnel them right down to the area you've got set up and then up to your car and out of there.
So you're exactly right. And when I view this thing on a map and, you know, having not been there, that's the next best thing. Check it out on a map. And I'm with you, Bob. Any case that we've looked at, if I have the ability to do so, because we cover cases out of the state of Ohio all the time, but
right.
Local cases, Columbus, Franklin County, Delaware County, any cases that are, you know, in Ohio that we cover, I drive to the place and I try to walk it. It just puts a whole different perspective on everything. You're able to visualize things. You're able to have a better understanding of the way that things went down and some of the difficulties, the obstacles that might have been involved. With this case, you see and you look at it on a map, if the trailhead is where they would have been dropped off by Kelsey.
Right.
And the problem for the perpetrator is that's where everybody goes. That's where everybody parks. That's where everybody enters the trail system. That's where everybody exits the trail system. That's where he, his vehicle, are going to be noticed and remembered. And he's going there to kill or kidnap, one of the
right.
two. And I will not be talked out of any of that. I've seen people online that are like, oh, he happened to just, no, he didn't just
no,
impulsively
bullshit. No
decide
way.
I'm going to try to control two victims.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like he was sitting there. And a lot of times these killers will do this. It's like going to a grocery store for you and I, where you're picking right. out your product. I think he sat there watching and waiting. And maybe this wasn't the first day that he sat there watching and waiting. He was looking for something.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
I think that for whatever reason, he decided to move on these two girls. And I didn't get to number two. I said one of two things of what would trigger her to film. Either they passed him, found him to be creepy, or if he was waiting somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine this? You're 12, 13-year-old girl. You're on the other side of the bridge. Now, Abby has never crossed that bridge before. That was the first right. day she's ever crossed the bridge. We know that Libby is looking back to take pictures of her friend to capture that moment and that memory and tweet right. it out or, you know, put it out on Snapchat. So she happens to be looking back. That's where she's going to see this man by himself, grown ass man by himself. You're a 12-year-old mm-hmm. girl. I would be instantly creeped out. You know, what's sure. this dude doing in the park by himself? He's not wearing a jogging outfit or anything like that. And then I think what may have triggered the filming portion is once he gets to the bridge. Okay. That's one thing. You see this creep. He's by himself, spooks you a little bit. Now, once right. he gets to the bridge, you're spooked a little more. He gets onto the bridge, heightens everything even more. And I think he was probably moving rather quickly across the bridge at a pace that they were uncomfortable with. He wants to zero in on them, move in on them fast. And I think what you said is spot on. This was a lot of strategy, a lot of thought put into this. This is a meticulous planner. And these people that plan out these horrific types of crimes, a big portion of the planning is to make sure, one, whatever fantasy or whatever they're trying to achieve does not fail,
right.
first of all. And then second of all, don't get caught. Act out fantasy is the first goal. Don't get caught is mm-hmm. the second goal. And they'll spend a lot of time planning on how I can achieve my fantasy or get close to it, because they never do. That's why they often reoffend.
Serial event, right?
But and then it's not to get caught. And I think you're right. I think park near the back of that graveyard so you don't have to be seen going in and out at the trail hill, at the trailhead. I'm sorry. And you could get to that location from that area, and you're almost taking the back door in if you would. But
right.
Yeah, and then we know, and this is where you got to let your mind wander. But you're not just doing this haphazardly. You can fill in some of these blanks by applying things that we know to be fact. So guys down the hill, he's directing them. He's controlling. He's attempting to control their movements. We can't say if he's attempting to move them to a kill site, attack site, or a vehicle to remove them from the area. We don't know that, but what we do know is he has already decided before he approached these girls that he's going to direct them to a location that he's already thought about. And I like the theory. The theory that I like the best is that I don't think his intention was to kill them there in that spot. I think murder was probably on the menu for this guy. But I've always kind of thought that maybe he was trying to remove them, to kidnap from that area. A lot of times, you know, and there's no nice way to put this. And so I hope and pray that family and friends are not listening to this because it makes me feel guilty and it breaks my heart. But a lot of times what these offenders want to do, this type of perpetrator wants to do, they want to spend a decent amount of time with the victim. And this would not be the ideal location to do so. There are people traveling that bridge. There are people walking those trails, some, you know, just for recreational purposes. So whatever it was that he set out to do, I don't think that he wanted to do it there. I think that something happened. I think that he had a hard time controlling the girls. I think that their bravery did not stop with the filming of Bridge Guy. I think they made this difficult on this dude. And I think he lost his composure or he panicked. And this was the sad result.
It's just so hard to know without having any details of the crime scene and, you know, and what all went down, you know, because, you know, it's a very different thing if it's, you know, their bodies are found and they're both beat over the head with a rock.
Right.
Then, you know, it tends to lean more towards what you're saying. Or if, you know, they were, you know, again, this is brutal, awful to think about. But, you know, if they're, you know, their clothing's removed and they're bound in some way and sexually assaulted, and there would be elements of the crime scene that indicate that maybe that's the nest that he had set up to do all those things that it was. But, you know, without knowing what exactly went down there, it's hard to make that determination. And then the other part of it is, again, for me, I like to see, like you, I want to see the crime. I want to walk, you know, in the Anand Syed case, when I was working on that in season one of Truth and Justice, I never understood why Haemin Lee was buried where she was buried. Didn't make sense. Okay. Looked at it on a map. They talk about this Leakin Park where she was buried, but it's not really a park. There's a road that drives. There's not much space there. Until I went to Baltimore and got in a vehicle and drove down that road. And then it was like, oh, there's houses, there's lights, there's stuff. And then when you turn this corner, if you're coming from this way, that is the first place where, one, you can get off the road, and two, get to a place where it's dark enough to do something like that. And then it's like, ding, that's why. That one wasn't premeditated. It was just, I got to find somewhere. There's the place.
Right.
And that's what I want to do. I want to walk down that hill, you know, go down the hill and see, okay, why did he choose to go here? What did this area look like? Were they on their way back up a hill, or were they like in a, you know, I'm serious about that. We're going to have to wrap this up here pretty soon, but we should go there and we should do a follow-up either on True Crime Garage or Binge and do a follow-up after going and walking the actual crime scene.
I think that's 100% we should do that. And you know, you're absolutely right too. So you have to think of the goal for the offender and how he is going to achieve the goal. And you go, well, maybe maybe he got lucky. Maybe he didn't put any thought into it. No, he's not been caught. The guy, we have his picture, we have his voice, and we still have not caught this guy. So he put some thought into this. And
right. In a small town, no less. In an area where you have to have knowledge of this trail system to do what he did in a small town and somehow still hasn't been caught. So, yeah, to say this is a dumb guy is not accurate.
No. And I think, you know, these guys, first of all, they have to go to a place where they know they're going to be able to find a victim.
Right.
You know, so, you know, shopping malls, places, public places are where these guys have to go to find their victim. Okay, so this guy's thinking about this. This is what he wants to do. This trail system will be great. There's people that go there for recreational purposes, walk a dog, go jogging. What I find to be interesting here is I think he was there for a while that day. I don't think it was his first day there. I don't think it was his first day there looking for a victim. He saw people by themselves and he passed on them for whatever reason. And I can't wrap my head around that, but there's a lot of planning that goes into this. One, he's thinking at first, this is the perfect place for me to find my victim. You go there. What do you learn real quick? Well, I can't just take someone off the trail because if I do that, I have to go past other people that will be on the trail with the victim in tow.
Right.
And I think you're absolutely right. He decided that I need somebody that's on that bridge. I need somebody that is on the other side of that bridge, because once I get over there with them, if I struggle or have trouble controlling the situation, there's not other people over there to see me, to witness what is going on.
And very quickly, you can move them down the hill. And you know, within seconds, even if somebody does go across the bridge, you're already out of sight.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You get out of sight from anybody on that bridge really quickly. So this is fascinating. I'm coming up on a hard out. I got to go pick up my kid. We need to follow up on this. Definitely want to have you back on the show sometime. And let's get together and let's go to Delphi and check this out. And because, you know, what's so frustrating about this is I'm so obsessed with solving this case and finding justice for Abby and Libby. And I just want to, you know, I do what I do. You know, I make these podcasts, I do these crowdsource and then investigations, but it's like, God, there's already people doing that. There's all these research, there's nothing you can get the police. I don't know what to do. I find myself frustrated wanting to do something. And that just feels like at least is doing something.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely want to do that. And I want to throw in just two pieces of information, because I know we did a lot of reckless speculation ourselves here, but I like to try to clear up some things that are obviously wrong with discussions about the case. And one is, you know, people point out that the date, when you look at someone's birthday and the day that they died, Libby and Abby have two different dates listed as the day that they died. And a lot of people point out that, oh, that means that law enforcement knows that one was killed the night that they went missing and the other one was killed sometime after midnight because they weren't found until around noon or so the next day. That does not point that out. That's not what that means. In most states in this great country, you can choose, the parent or the next of kin can choose when it's not known when the person died. You can choose and you can pick between when they went missing or when they were found. And I think it's just simply a situation where, for whatever reason, the parents of one girl chose the date that they went missing. The other parents chose the date that they were found. And so that's not proof of anything. It's just, it's just happened. It's like JonBenet Ramsey, right?
Right.
They go, oh, well, law enforcement knows that she was killed on this day, even though it was a crime that happened overnight. No, it's just the date that her parents chose to put on the grave, on the tombstone. So that's one thing that I like to clear up. And the other thing, too, that's a big misconception is law enforcement has not released a whole lot of information, as we've discussed already. However, one thing that they have said is the girls were killed where they were found.
Right.
The girls were killed where they were found. And there's a lot of rumor out there that maybe they were removed or that they were killed elsewhere and brought back. I don't know how it could be any more clear. They were killed where they were found. Were they Were they found in the nude? Were they found fully clothed? The other, were they wearing each other's clothing? We know from the radio calls and from witness statements that they would have at least been partially undressed or partially clothed, however you want to look at it, because we do know
they find some clothes first, right?
They found some articles of clothing first. So that's another thing that we can clear up. But yeah, Bob, I'm with you. I know the captain would love the adventure as well. I think we go out to Delphi, we walk the ground, we talk to who. I would love to sit in a diner and hear what the local scuttlebutt is on this thing too, because I really feel that law enforcement has spoke to Bridge Guy. I think that there's a problem with the case. And I think what the problem is, and I've said this on True Crime Garage, we've covered the case 7 different episodes for an hour long. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with the case is I think somebody has provided a false alibi for Bridge Guy. And that's where the disconnect is between law enforcement being able to hone in on this dude. And that is also why I think we might have 2 sketches. I think it's potentially that one of the guys, because they look like different people to me.
Sure. Yeah. One looks much older.
Yeah. And I just wonder, is the guy in sketch 1 providing a false alibi for guy in sketch 2 or the reverse of that? I think somebody knows who did this. And I think they're, for whatever reason, they're providing a false alibi for Bridge Guy. And until we get past that, I mean, I don't know. My heart breaks for the families of these victims. This is a horrific crime, one of the most horrific crimes I can think of in the recent years. And, you know, I just hope and pray that this, sooner than later, you and I are having a much different discussion about this case.
I sure hope so. And with that being said, that's Nick. He is one of the hosts of the True Crime Garage podcast, along with his co-host, Captain. They have 7 episodes on the Delphi case to check out. So check them out. They could be your next big true crime binge. Nick, thanks so much for joining me.
Bob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.